According to the U.S. Census, the number of people who consider themselves multiracial has grown by 32% over the past decade. On the one hand, bridging two or more cultures can be a rich and rewarding experience. Yet America's troubled racial past and current complicated attitudes about race can pose challenges for biracial families, adults, and children. Among them, where does a biracial person fit in, and what should they call themselves? I'm Susan Wilson, and today on Central Standard, we'll start off by talking about what it's like to belong to two worlds. Later in the show, we'll explore some myths about nudism and naturism and learn about how being a nudist promotes an appreciation of body image. Join us for these discussions just after this hour's news. What do Barack Obama, Halle Berry, and Bob Marley have in common? They're all biracial and represent a swiftly growing census category. That means more people are checking the box labeled biracial or multiracial. Over the past decade, the number of mixed-race babies has skyrocketed. Many believe this is a result of more interracial marriages and a cultural shift away from the so-called one-drop rule. That's where one drop of black blood makes one black, toward embracing a biracial identity. Biracial people are in the unique position to navigate between two worlds and benefit from the cultural experiences of their mixed racial heritage. Yet many biracial people face an identity crisis and a struggle to fit in an America that has a painful and complicated racial past. This is Central Standard, and I'm Susan Wilson. Today we'll begin Central Standard with a discussion of what it's like for parents, children, and young adults to bridge two cultures, two worlds. For our first segment, our guests are Sarah Starnes, co-founder and former VP of the Multiracial Family Circle. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you.
And also Janae Osterhout, columnist for the Kansas City Star. Good morning.
Good morning.
And last but not least, Dr. Sean Alexander, professor of African and African American Studies, department at KU. Hi, Sean. Dr. Sean.
Good morning.
So I want to start off by asking you, Dr. Alexander, have attitudes toward interracial marriage and biracial identity, have they really changed? And what's influenced the change?
Well, I think, I think they do. They have changed over time. But at the same time, we have incidences where we come back and we question whether or not we have changed. Right. We have recently the commercial, the Cheerios commercial, that had such a backlash, right?
And we're going to talk about that.
Right,
in a
I figured
minute.
You would. So you have the backlash regarding that. You have the questions, you know, of Barack Obama and President Barack Obama and his parents, right? And people seem to accept it, but they still categorize them as black. They don't categorize them as a mixed race. Right?
Well, I was going to ask you about that. What about the biracial category itself? Hasn't that been controversial in terms of whether biracial people should be considered black or biracial? Can you just talk briefly about that?
Sure. When there was a push for that to change in the census, it was pushed by biracial communities, by biracial families to add that box. But just because you can check a box doesn't necessarily mean that the attitudes of the community, of the nation as a whole, have changed, right? It shows that you can define who you are on the census, but as far as how society will view you, that box does not necessarily change that view.
And, of course, there were laws against interracial marriage in this country. Can you just, in a nutshell, tell us the history of that and what some of the fears were that drove those prohibitions?
Sure. I think the first thing that you have really coming out of slavery was a pivotal year is 1883. We have a number of laws passed, and one of those laws is Pace versus Alabama, which ends all interracial marriage. It's tied also to the Supreme Court decision in the civil rights cases that happens in 1883 that allows segregation to develop, right? So you can see all these things beginning in 1883 on a national legal scale. And that basically, once that is the Pace versus Alabama is set into place, many states begin to also pass anti-miscegenation laws, state-by-state cases. And that will take place throughout the entire more than almost a century, and it's really struck down by Loving versus Virginia in 1967 when they come back and the Supreme Court rules that that it is okay for Richard and Mildred Loving to be married. And we have to remember that they were put in jail for a year for marrying each other, right? For being in love and going and being married. And they escaped to D.C. for a while and then keep coming back and forth to Virginia. But they are put in prison for their love. And that's...
So in the interest of full disclosure, I'm biracial myself. And so I'm interested, Janae, how did you deal with the question that every biracial person is asked? What are you?
It's one of those questions where I think as a child, I didn't know what to say because I just thought, what? So often I would just be confused at what they were asking because I didn't understand. Over time, as I got older, I started having fun. I would just say, oh, a human, an alien, I'm purple, you know, just whatever I want. Every now and then I'll seriously answer it. But
well, how do you see yourself, by the way?
I see myself as both biracial and black, both. Mm-hmm. I know, like, Barack Obama checked the African-American box on the census. I choose biracial in that case. But I'm biracial with the understanding that the world still sees me as a black woman most of the time. I mean, sometimes people think I'm Puerto Rican or...
You know, I get that a lot,
yeah.
Too.
So I guess I see myself, you know, biracial with the understanding that I'm still, to very many people, a black woman.
Now, Sarah Starnes, you certainly have had some experience with this. You have biracial children. So talk to me about your thoughts about the right to choose one's identity.
Well, we started the Multiracial Family Circle in 1991. It was three black women, Sherry Payne, Kathleen MacArthur, Tina Worth, and I, and we all had interracial, biracial kids, and we wanted them to be able to be around families like theirs. Over the years, more adoptive families, transracial adoptive families got involved. We've had some interracial couples involved, some people who themselves were multiracial, and that's still a very diverse group of people. So we were able to come up with three basic principles that we all agreed on, which is that people should be able to self-define their race. They should be able to check more than one box on forms asking about race, and they shouldn't be denied the ability to adopt due solely to race, although we didn't rule out that a judge or a social worker should be able to consider how the parents will meet the identity needs of their children. So we used to meet monthly. We'd have speakers, quarterly social events. We did some actions like a bone marrow registry drive, and as the children would grow, sometimes the parents would kind of, you know, drift away, but I stayed involved longer than most because I felt like I had to give back because people had helped me come along.
Well, let me ask you this. How did you advise your children when they're asked the same question that Janae and I were often asked, especially as children? Mm-hmm. What are you?
Well, I've tried to help my kids understand that, you know, this is not, the world in life is not really black and white. You can be more than one thing. So in some circumstances, you know, if you might be black because people see you as black and the world treats you as you're black. But the actual reality is that you're biracial. So you decide for yourself in what circumstances, you know, you want to be black and what circumstances you want to be biracial.
Now, Janae, hearing what Sarah just said, what are the complications, though, with trying to bridge those two ways of thinking?
There are just so many complications because, you know, I might see myself as biracial and black, but then, you know, I've been in situations with my friends and even my family members who are black where I will commiserate with them on something that we've all gone through, and they'll say, but you're mixed, or you're not really black. And
how do you feel when they say that?
Hurt. Mm-hmm. Hurt because, you know, I'm biracial and I embrace both sides of my family, but I very much know what it's like to be called the N-word and be left out and be judged by the color of my skin. I mean, when readers hate me, one of the first things they say is "you people" and, you know, things like that.
Now, school, when you're a biracial person, can be really hard. Why?
You don't really know where you fit in, especially as a child. I think things could be different now, but not much because I do mentor a mixed girl and she goes through the things I went through. But I was in a lot of talented and gifted classes, and at the time they were mostly white. and I wouldn't get invited to all the birthday parties. But then my black cousins would beat me up for being high yellow and having
red bone,
salt and pepper, a whole special kind of slur for mixed people in the certain kind of hair. So they didn't want to hang out with me. So I found myself spending a lot of time with the Puerto Rican kids. They didn't judge.
Yeah, I think that's why I felt very comfortable in Brazil, because Brazil is such a multiracial country that you really fit in immediately. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Susan Wilson, and we're talking about being biracial with our guest Sarah Starnes, a founder of the Multiracial Family Circle, Janae Osterhelt, columnist for the Kansas City Star, and Dr. Sean Alexander, professor of African and African-American Studies at KU. What about you, Sarah? What was your kids' school experience like, and how did you have to help them through that?
Well, they both started out in public school in Kansas City, Missouri, and especially my daughter, when I took her out of public school, I felt some angst about that. But I wanted her to have the very best possible education. So when I chose, Kansas City, Missouri public school people, I admire people who keep their kids in public school is what I'm trying to say. But the private school we chose had, you know, a mission statement about diversity. They have a diverse board. They try to incorporate these kinds of principles in everything they do. But my kids, you know, they've had experiences where, like, well, only kids with white skin can play here. But even in the public school, my daughters, the black kids would say to my daughter, that can't be your mom. She's white. So the main thing is you allow your kids the opportunity to talk about it. You let them talk about their feelings about it. And you talk to the other parents about it. And you talk to the teacher about it. And if necessary, you talk to the principal about it. So they really haven't had very many bad experiences. I've kind of protected them because I believe in living, working, playing, worshiping in racially diverse circumstances, and diverse meaning not only just black and white, but diverse in many ways.
What about you? Are you biracial or raising a biracial child? What has been your experience? Join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Now, I want to talk about this very controversial Cheerios commercial that has caused quite a backlash because of its portrayal of a biracial family and people's reactions to that. Janae, what was your take on this commercial?
I was so excited, so, so excited, because, you know, people think, oh, that's simple, they're just eating cereal, but you don't see families that look like mine on TV, even now in 2013 with the president that we have. You just don't see it. So when I saw it, I was immediately excited. And because it was, you know, I hate to say that I got some sense of validation through Cheerios, but it did feel that way because, you know, all my life I've had people look at me, my mom, and my sister. My sister is not mixed. She's white. And think that I'm just my sister's friend.
Huh.
Or in seventh grade, the kids started a rumor that I was adopted.
I know when my mother used to babysit my kids, it was common for people to ask her, are you the housekeeper? Are you their babysitter? Because my kids are very brown skinned, and so they just couldn't put the two and two together. Now, Dr. Alexander, what do you think in terms of some of the social, political realities of our country? What do you think led to the big backlash? Because a lot of people were responding to the commercial with some very negative comments.
Well, I think, there are a couple of different things that I think came into play with that. And I think the number one thing is it's not the first time we've had an interracial marriage actually portrayed on television. This is what we had, and I think this is key, and this will probably be controversial, which is why the commercial is controversial. But I think the key was it was a black father and a white woman. That was the role. If you pay attention to what's on the media, almost always it is the African American female and the white male.
Now, why is that so socially charged? That image.
I think it's socially charged 100% because it's the image of the what we've had in our history of the fearing of the black man. The black man is predator. All of that is continually drives our society and our fears of race. I mean, we had it played out within the last 2 weeks in our decisions in the Trayvon Martin case. If you watch the end of that hearing and the closing arguments, they talked about the woman hovering within, you know, in her house with a ill-prepared scissors to protect herself from burglars, right? So it's that image of this black male coming into the white male, the white woman's house
And the history of black men being lynched, even if they looked at a white woman.
Absolutely. And it's not only that they would be lynched for their for looking at a white woman, but they would it was often used as the justification whether that was the crime or not, right? Someone could be open a grocery store across the street from a white grocery store, and that it's a threat, an economic threat. And then they come back and say, well, he was actually talking to this white woman, so that's why we've lynched them, when they have no evidence of that. Ida B. Wells did a wonderful job of exposing that myth tied to the lynchings.
Sarah, you had a comment.
Right. Well, my daughter, Imani Starnes, she's an actress, and, you know, being an actor, it's all about your looks, and sometimes she's been cast in roles in a colorblind way. So it just now occurred to me when Sean was talking about this, she is in an ad where she's married to a white guy and these other two people are presumably his white parents, and there was no pushback about that at all. So, you know, maybe what Sean's saying is true, which doesn't mean that she doesn't have challenges in her career for being biracial.
Oh, Janae.
Oh, I was just going to say I 100% agree. When I wrote about that commercial in favor of it, I had people complain about the father and how, you know, if it was reality, there would have been a father. He would have left them, or he would have been in jail, and all of these really nasty stereotypes. And then I had a woman call and tell me that basically I shouldn't exist and I shouldn't write columns. I should be more socially responsible and not write columns encouraging interracial marriage and interracial children.
Wow. Wow, a sign of the fact that we've come a long way in race relations, but maybe not far enough. Let's take a caller. Garnet, welcome to Central Standard this morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Good. You had a comment or a question?
Yes. Well, I'm multiracial, but here's the question I'd like to ask. But let me first state what I am. I am mostly white, some Mohawk Indian, some black. Mohawk and black, each about 3%, maybe less. And when I am asked, just to be more accurate, I check other, which I don't like. I don't like being another. And if I were to check multiracial and have people automatically assume I'm all black, I would really take issue with that. So I would like to ask the question, just for discussion, do the panelists believe that some black people may make a bigger deal about color than some white people? And I'll take the answer up here.
Thank you, Garnet. Well, what say you?
I think it's fair to say some, because it's true. I think that there are some. I just think it's very important that we say some. There are definitely some black people who make race a bigger deal than some white people. I just think overall that's not the case.
Now, Dr. Alexander, if black people are a little bit more sensitive about some of these issues around race and color from a historical, socio-political perspective, why might that be?
Because of the history that we've had, right? That African American history, first of all, is American history. We have to understand that it's central to what we are as a nation, and every flashpoint in American history has been almost always an African American related issue. And what we have is a race of people, what we define as a race of people, as a nation, always being kept out or always being kept at the outside. So you're always going to come back to that issue of race. Race is always going to be central to that discussion, no matter what we have occurring in society. Race is always going to permeate, no different. And our misunderstanding of race, I think, is very important. It comes back to this idea of understanding what is African American, what is black in society. And to use, you know, our interracial president as a perfect example, a very quick perfect example, when he was going to become inaugurated for the first time and take the oath of office, they kept making a big deal about that he was going to stand on the steps that his ancestors built, mm-hmm. right? He's Kenyan American, right? He's not. His ancestors are not of the American slave past. He actually told us that in March 2008 when he gave a speech on race. His daughters are, because Michelle's ancestors are of the American slave past, right? So there is a difference right there from the beginning. You know, how should you actually define President Obama, right? The nation defines him as black. Mm-hmm. He is Kenyan American. He doesn't change his citizenship, so let's get that direct right away. But I think that you know, we have to understand that. What do we do with this new group? You know, the largest group of African Americans in the country today are people of Caribbean and of African descent, right? Mm-hmm. But they are classified as African American. So mm-hmm. we have various ratios of what we define as black.
And that leads to a lot of different
Absolutely.
Complexities, doesn't it?
Yes.
Janae, you had a comment.
Well, to add to what he was saying about race sometimes being a bigger deal for blacks, I think that we deal with race on a daily basis in ways that people don't understand. And sometimes it's not always hateful, but it's still racially ignorant. I was at the pool and I had sunblock, and a white lady a couple of seats down was out of sunblock, and I heard her saying she needed sunblock, so I offered her mine. She was shocked that I had sunblock. And I have people in my office who someone gets a tan and they say, oh, you got a tan. I say, oh, I was tanning too. And it's like they're confused that I got a tan. Or if somebody black is walking with me, I've had white friends say, oh, is that your husband? And it's not my husband. It's just someone black walking with me. So there's just always these very ignorant things that come up that you deal with. I mean, I had a neighbor who was shocked because I knew that she was listening to Reba. And I said, oh, that's Reba. I like Reba. Oh, you listen to country?
Mm-hmm. As if you shouldn't.
Exactly.
Be.
So I'm not saying these things are hateful at all, but it's a type of racial ignorance that you have to deal with on a daily basis when you are black.
And you and I have even talked about hair, that if you're a biracial person, it's very complicated getting your hair to look just right and finding people can actually do your hair. Now, that seems like a minor point here, but
It's not. It's a sore point on both ends. I mean, you might encounter black people who are like, oh, you have good hair. You've got the good hair. You've got, you know, just add water hair. But you have white people who don't want to put their fingers in your hair, or the opposite. All they can do is ask you to touch it like you're a zoo animal.
And beauticians may not know what to do with it because it's of its texture.
Yes.
Yes, Sarah.
In fact, the multiracial family circle, that was one of our most popular groups. Every year we'd have somebody come in and talk about taking care of hair.
So as we think about how parents can help biracial children, what do you think are some of the do's and don'ts as you prepare kids?
Well, I think that it's important not to emphasize too much how people are not going to like you because of your race, because I think you want to establish that inner core of I'm worthwhile, I'm good. It's important for your kids to know they're good and you love them regardless of what they look like or what they do. They just are. And at the same time, I think if it's a safety issue, you need to let them know about, you know, bad things happen because of race sometimes. I think you need to let them know that black people are not more criminal or you know, incapable of making money. There's historic things and things going on right now that have created this disproportionate number of black people in prisons and in, you know, segregated places and not having as high an income. But I think it's key to help them be able to talk about race, to be able to talk about their feelings, to be around other people that look like them, other families that look like them, because a sense of belonging is kind of a basic human need. So I would say don't emphasize it too much, but keep the door open to talk about it and just love them for all they are and help them see that there's other people that look like them that are somebody that they can really want to be like.
Did you have a comment?
I just wanted to add, and I've come across this a lot, is I think one thing parents could do that would be helpful is not pretend that we're in a colorblind world and that it's, you know, so euphoric.
Because you hear some parents saying, I just tell my biracial child they're a child of God, which doesn't really prepare them for the realities of how people might respond to them.
At all. And I also have encountered, and I don't know if you could speak to this, about when white parents feel offended or neglected, like they say, you're just as much white as you are black. Scientifically, that may be true, but socially, it's just not. And I think it's hard sometimes if you think you're offending your parent by explaining your experience to them.
Right. So we're going to take a caller right now. Regina from North Kansas City, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And you have a question.
Yes, I have a question. My grandfather, he's passed, was a white man, and we grew up here, but then I was raised in California, San Diego, and then I lived the majority of my life in New York. Well, I'm here in Missouri now, and our kids are grown and in college. And my son, our youngest son, is engaged to a beautiful young white woman, and they live out in Leawood. And when they come over on the weekends, they talk about issues as far as the stares that they get. And my son, even in high school, because they've been dating since junior high, will say every time something came up missing in the school, he would be accused of it because there were only a few black students. And myself was socialized in a white setting, but we were never taught about this, and I didn't really experience it till I came to Missouri.
So what's your question? Because we're kind of running short of time. What's your question?
My question is, as a mother, what can I tell them? Are there any books that I can read to help me be able to support them? And is there a state in the United States that we as a family could probably move to where it would be more diverse?
So part of what she's asking is what about the climate here in Kansas City for biracial people, and what advice do you give for support for a young biracial multiracial couple?
I try not to tell other people how to live their lives. I just know that it's worked well for me to, as I said earlier, live in a place where there's other families that look like my family, there's other kids that look like my kids, and to worship at a place like that, and to work at a place like that, and to, play in a place like that. And I think that avoids a lot of problems. And true enough, there's not a lot of places like that around here. So you have to seek them out deliberately.
And I think the same would be true of schools as well.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So we have time for one more call. And so, good morning, Joe. Welcome to Central Standard. How are you?
Good morning.
And make your question brief because we're running out of time.
Yes, I'd like to know how parents, biracial children, the white parents feel, especially grandparents feel, about their biracial grandchildren.
Oh, okay. So, what are your thoughts about that, Janae?
My white grandparents didn't want to meet me. So when I was born, my mother couldn't take me home for a while, for a couple years. My great-grandparents said I was pretty for an N-word.
Mm.
And over time, this changed. Over time, we built a relationship. But initially, it was definitely frowned upon. And his question was just about that set of grandparents, correct? Yeah.
Yes.
Initially, it was frowned upon.
Well, I know in my instance, the Italian side of my family, my mother's mother and sister embraced me, but her father and brother did not. And so there were only certain times we could go over to the house to visit. So, Sarah.
And I've had friends who have been, quote, disowned by their parents. But in most cases, when they have kids, the parents can, kind of have a light bulb go off, and they can change. That, to me, shows that people can change.
So real briefly, what advice do you give to biracial people and families? We're getting ready to close, but just very briefly, a couple of words. Janae?
You have the right to, only you can define you. Your identity is yours. And I often tell people, mind your own identity.
Sarah?
I would just say, do whatever you can for yourself and your kids to get to that point where you really believe and feel that your self-worth comes from within.
And Dr. Alexander.
I would echo what they said, and I think a key is also to understand, to seek out that community that you are welcome in, and know that you are part of this nation, no matter how someone defines you.
We want to thank our guest for this segment today, Sarah Starnes, former VP and founder of the Multiracial Family Circle, Janae Osterhout, columnist for the Kansas City Star, and Dr. Sean Alexander, KU African American Studies Department. Thanks so much for being with us today. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we will shift our conversation to nudism and naturism right here in the Heartland. Central Standard returns in just one moment.